There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. I'm Brandy Scott. This evening we're asking, are blind CVs the way forward? No age, no gender, no nationality. Doesn't mean no prejudice. Plus, Emirates is delaying the launch of its premium economy class till December 2020. We're going to find out why. And with the giant cityscape real estate event just 48 hours away, Eldar, the Abu Dhabi developer, is going to tell us about how it's giving 10% discounts on villas and apartments. Man Al-Awlaki is the executive director of commercial at Eldar Properties.
Dubai is seen as a global hub. It attracts investors from all over the world. It attracts a whole different demographics and expats to the country. And we'd like to capitalize on that, given that we're going to be here in the expo for the next 10 days, additionally the Cityscape as well event, we decided to come up with a perfect 10.
We've seen real estate deals before and developers come up with deals. This is bigger and bolder than probably anything I've seen before from a UAE developer. How would you quantify it?
Oh, very true, spot on. I mean, Richard, recently we've seen new customers virtually in every launch or promo that we do. Roughly about 60-70% of our customers are new. We'd like to capitalize that further on. This is why we're here in Dubai. This is why we have the perfect 10. It's the first time we've done something of this kind and magnitude for our customers. And again, it's about bringing in fresh new customers.
Whatever business you're in, whether you're selling cars or computers or advertising like we are, discounting is something that any principal has to be wary about. You don't do it lightly. When you had those conversations within Eldar, how did you weigh up the pros and cons of doing this?
A lot of our discussions and eventual decision-making is done with data. We rely on data significantly. We have historical data and we have forward-looking data indicators. Historical tends to look at our database and what trends that we see there via new launches, via incentives, via promotions. What are our customers buying? What are they telling us? What's the data telling us? And then there's the forward-looking indicators where we actually send out surveys and question, what do we do next? Let the customer tell us. Let him direct us, him or her. And in that sense, that's what brought forward this incentive plan, Perfect 10. 10 years discount, 10 years free service charge, the whole load, 10 years building, 10 years maintenance on us, 10 years of tickets, vouchers, whatever the customer wants within our destinations.
Let's talk about what the data is telling you about where the strong points for demand are at the moment, because this week you've got everything from you can buy a plot as an Emirati to build what is verging on a palace if you want, or an expat can come and buy a studio or a one-bed apartment for a few hundred thousand dirhams. Within that broad spectrum, where are you seeing the real sweet spot at the moment?
I mean, the sweet spot varies over time. We're very dynamic. Our sweet spot this year, for example, was land sales, which we saw pent-up demand for, so we rolled them out. We rolled out of Abu Dhabi town, Riman, which is a mid-market product, and that sold out very well.
And that was just buying land plots.
And then we went up the income segment to Saadiyat Reserve recently, which sold also very well.
And that was finished villas or that was land?
That was also land plots. Okay. So that was one asset class, which is land, within different income segments and locations in the same year.
And what kind of price points were we talking about for those? You talk about mid-market or more upscale?
The mid-market Riman plots were on the sub 700,000 dirhams starting, with the starting price in Saadiyat Reserve being roughly double that. So different income segments, and both selling very well. So we tend to constantly mine our data and think of what to do next. We're very dynamic, we're very nimble, we have a very successful destination strategy where we have different destinations that we can offer our customers to. And within that, different asset classes, different income segments.
Let's talk about the customers who are buying from you at the moment. Obviously, in a place like Abu Dhabi, the bedrock, the anchor, will be the very strong and relatively affluent Emirati population. But over and above that, you've got the resident expatriate population. And then, of course, you're looking outside of the UAE, people who are non-resident in the UAE looking maybe just for investment purposes, maybe for a second home. Talk me through the demographics of the different groups that are buying real estate in Abu Dhabi in general and from Al Dhar in particular.
In general, the UAE national tends to be the majority or dominant force in our investor base. And even that, it's not that much of a lion's share. It's a majority, but it's probably in some projects reaching up to only 60%, with the rest being expatriates.
And
a
that
big
be
number
like,
of Arab expats.
That would be the Emiratis buying. What do you know about whether they're mainly buying to live in these properties or buying them as an investment? How does that mix?
Yeah, it honestly, Richard, it tends to be buying as an investor and leasing out to an expat upon delivery. And we've seen different projects and different data points on projects that have been launched and handed over years ago. And you've seen that shift from Emiratis owners initially all the way into the expat owners being a majority. And that's because whoever was leasing actually enjoyed it so much that turned into an owner. And hopefully now with our perfect 10 years free service charge, such as that 10% discount, we're getting a lot of expats coming in now. And I really think this data point coming out of this campaign will show us where the expats are actually lion's share.
I kind of wish I'd had that kind of offer when I bought my home here in Dubai, but that was 4 or 5 years ago. It was a different time. A couple of final questions. You talked about Emiratis in particular buying as investors and overseas investors, maybe even institutional investors. What kind of yields, or what's the range of yields that people are getting on your properties at the moment in ballpark terms?
So obviously it depends from project to project and whether it's an end user project or product or whether it's an investor led product. I mean, a significant number of our products are in handover stage, so we can't comment on the actual yields that they're being given right now. But from our projections, for example, on Saadiyat Reserve, which is a land plot that we launched recently, that's a land plot worth about 1.8 million. And if you're thinking you're going to build the GFA allocated on it for about 4,000 dirhams a square foot, that's another 2 million on top. So you're looking at about 3.8 to 4 million dirhams for a finished product on Saadiyat. The closest villa plot, 4-bed, on Saadiyat is for 6 million. So you immediately have that capital appreciation of about 38%. And you can apply the same on the yields. So the yields on that would easily hit towards a double digit.
That is the voice of Man Al-Alaki, Executive Director Commercial at Al Dhar Properties, speaking to us ahead of the big Cityscape event in Dubai, which starts in 2 days' time.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. I'm Brandy Scott.
I would rather go blind, boy.
Blind CVs, Brandy Scott, what are they and why do we care?
They're CVs in which no one knows who you are, where you came from, what you want or what you're doing. No, they are CVs where your gender, your nationality, your age and possibly even your name aren't mentioned in order to stop any unconscious bias. The research shows from around the world that unconscious bias is present in nearly every market based on those factors.
You've been doing some research into this, and intuitively, I think we all guessed that this might be the case, but the stats and the research are shocking.
Yeah, and I didn't even need to do very much research to find a lot of research, if that makes any sense. There have been a lot of studies done around the world, a lot of them by governments, having a look at what happens if you take a CV, keep the qualifications the same, and just change the age, the gender, or the sound of the name. So if we take the sound of the name, for example, let's take a Canadian study from the University of Toronto, 13,000 fake resumes, as they call CVs in Canada. Those with Pakistani, Indian or Chinese sounding names were 28% less likely to get to the interview stage than the fake candidates with English sounding names.
I mean, that is staggering.
Oh, staggering.
Because that's a country where there is a lot of very strong regulation about this, and it was one of the pioneers of regulation against this kind of thing decades ago. And for you to still be seeing that level of discrimination, you'll always get a little bit, but that level of discrimination is just incredible.
Yeah, the discrimination, by the way, was larger coming out of small firms than larger multinationals. The UK, similar studies done by the government, also by the Nuffield College Centre for Social Investigation. They found that names that sounded like they had a Pakistani heritage had to make 70% more applications. Middle Eastern or North African sounding heritage, 90% more applications. The same thing's been done with age in San Francisco. Job applicants that were 25, fake job applicants, more likely to receive positive responses than 50-year-olds. There have been studies done in Australia, New Zealand, where Simon Cook and Susan Campbell, who had the same CVs, were both put forward for the same jobs. Simon a lot more likely to get callbacks than Susan. I could go on.
We've been getting loads of response on this, as you might imagine. We'll hear some of your views in a second. But first of all, let's get the expert perspective. Margie Mommerts is based in Dubai, has been for many, many years. She is a human resources and recruitment consultant, the head of Margie Mommerts People Advisory. We asked her whether she's in favour of the idea of blind CVs, and this is what Margie told us.
I like it because of the fact that, again, if you look at age, for example, a lot of people in this market, once they hit the age of 40, they're finding it a lot harder. A lot of people are coming into the market from Europe or the America. So they tend to be of that younger age. So it's easier for them to find jobs if you've got a 35 on your CV. And clients do specify age when you go into a client meeting. Client needs analysis, as we call it. They tell us exactly what they need. And that does come across. I want this age, this gender, different thing.
Margie was also asked, is there any legal framework against this sort of bias? And this is what she told us.
The point on legal, again, that's federal law. You're probably well aware. So discrimination and hatred law come in. It's not specific to recruitment. Yes, we're not allowed to legally say gender, nationality, age on a job posting, for example. But it happens. It still happens. By law, we're not supposed to do it. For example, if you look at some clients will go in and say, I want this great finance manager. He has to have these qualifications, this experience, blah, blah, blah. And at the end of it, you'll find that he'll say, and the salary is 12,000. Well, as an experienced recruiter, you know that 12,000 for that kind of job description is definitely going to be someone from Asia. For example, it's not going to be a Western expat. They wouldn't come here on this massive job as a finance manager for 12,000.
Right. Well, we have had many, many comments in from listeners, as you would expect. This is Aisel. He is in favour of blind CVs.
My wife has recently been applying for jobs here. And one of the challenges that you face over here is that there's an absolute bias when it comes to nationalities and, you know, the sort of age group that you're in. And there's also, it's also necessary to put up a picture on your resume, especially if you're applying to events or marketing. And, you know, that definitely creates a bias. So I think a blind CV would definitely go a long way in, you know, reducing the bias when it comes to recruitment.
Yeah, Najim says that he's also in favour of not specifying nationality because he has faced discrimination himself.
You know, even though I'm more than 100 and 200% fit for the job description, but they usually picked it up, the same nationality people, which, you know, most of the hiring manager are. And they won't allow people like me getting into that area. I mean, I just recently interviewed a very large organization. In fact, the largest organization, you know, they don't even care about interviewing me. It was just like a filler. When I went there for interviewing, it was like his body language completely, you know, it's showing that he's not even interested in even putting a question in front of me. I'm really surprised because I came from USA and I felt it, and I work over there in a Fortune 500 company, and I know that these type of things like asking nationality, asking your age is forbidden over there. They don't even consider these things.
Now, we have had people writing in defense almost of discrimination in job adverts. The next person we're going to hear from says, look, they might as well put it in the job advert because that's what they want. So there's no point pretending to be politically correct in the job advert when everyone's just going to be filtered out at the interview stage. Anyway, it was an anonymous caller, but this is what she said.
It depends on the employer, and they eventually are going to hire the people they want. So I prefer to have it up front, clear what the employer is asking for, as opposed to wasting my time sending CVs to people who ultimately are not going to even hire me. So I think it's better to be straightforward in what you're looking for.
Fair enough. I guess I can see why you would say that. You don't want to have your time wasted and go through a 3-week interview process when you've got no chance of getting the job anyway.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai I 103.8.
Good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. I'm Brandy Scott.
Our talking point is the rise of the so-called blind CV. This is a CV that doesn't have your age, your nationality, your gender, and in some cases, not even your name, in a bid to avoid discrimination. So you are judged purely on your merits rather than on your demographics. One of the potential solutions to the inherent, sometimes unconscious bias when people are recruiting is to use artificial intelligence and robots to do the selection rather than people. And joining us in the studio now is the founder of a recruitment firm that does just that. Sahika Bennett is the CEO of Searchy. Sahika, thanks very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We'll get on to Searchy, your company, in a second and what it's doing to try and combat this. But first of all, the issue of blind CVs. I know this is something you're passionate about. In fact, you read the same article in Gulf News this weekend that we did, and it really spoke to you. Mm-hmm. Give us your thoughts.
Yeah, I think when I read it, there was obviously some research done behind it. And I did feel quite strongly because I do think there are solutions in the region for sure, like Searchy, where we are doing exactly that, taking away gender, not asking for nationality. And it's all about the hiring process. I think the norm is, without a doubt, to include those details, but we're actually taking a conscious step away from that because we do want the individual to be judged for who they actually are.
How big a problem is this? Not just here in Dubai, the UAE, the region where you live now, but in your native United Kingdom?
Huge. This is a problem that exists everywhere. I think the difference between this region and maybe the Western region is they've taken steps to at least put things in place, like it's illegal to have gender or date of birth on your CV and things like that. Whereas I think here we haven't really the steps haven't been there formally, like legally as such, like adhered to as they are. They're more conscious of it in the US and UK.
What did you see in the United Kingdom in terms of this kind of discrimination of age, of gender, of nationality, ethnicity, whatever it may be?
I remember being about 21 years old, and I remember my old boss at BT, where I worked at the time, and putting a CV in the bin. We won't be hiring one of those, was exactly what he said. I was shocked, really, really shocked to see discrimination so obvious in front of me. Having said that, that was a really long time ago. So I do think from there, companies are accountable, right? So I do feel like there's many stats they have to present every year in terms of their diversity to prove that they are hiring in a diverse way.
I guess when you think of a position, if you're a company, you want a role to fill, you draft up what you might like in that position, the sort of person that might fit in, young, dynamic, or slightly older, you want the experience, etc. But you'd also have in the back of your mind a salary. And quite often the salary that you set for that would delimit the type of people that might be able to accept it, because it is a salary that appeals to different nationalities, depending on how senior it is. How do you work the salaries into a blind CV? That's what I don't really quite understand. Is if your best applicant is the most expensive one to hire as well, your budget doesn't allow for that, you're wasting your own time by interviewing people you can't afford.
I disagree. I think that let's leave this to the individuals, right? I've met some amazing people that are maybe directors or VPs that have been made redundant or lost their jobs. Salary to them is not the thing, right? To some people, money is really important. To other people, it's about having a job, being in the job that they love. So it shouldn't really be for the employer to decide that, okay, age is a reflection of salary. No, leave it to the individuals to be applying for jobs that they're well aware of and be willing to work for that, right? I took a huge pay cut when I moved to Dubai, and that was out of choice because I really wanted to move here and move for the job and move for the right reasons, right? So put it on the individual. The employers shouldn't automatically assume. And I think that's the problem with recruitment these days. There are so many assumptions.
Well, I think there'd be a certain amount of suspicion if you're trading down in terms of salary. Everyone says, well, why on earth would you trade down?
Well, people, people really, if they're working for something that they really want to make an impact in, for example, I meet people who want to maybe move into data science, have no experience, but have got some good understanding of IT. Now, they will be willing to take a hit short term for a pay cut to move into that area if the employer is willing to train them. And really, training shouldn't just be defined on age, and it shouldn't just be like the youth.
Age is a very difficult one, isn't it, really? Because there are more and more people having to work longer until their pensions kick in. People are perhaps a little bit poorer than they used to be into your 50s and 60s. And yet, if you want somebody who's going to be with you for 20 or 30 years, obviously employing somebody who's 55 or 60 years old is not going to be the answer. At some point, when you get face to face, that discrimination will kick in.
Yeah, I think it exists without a doubt. It exists whether we're looking at nationalities, whether we're looking at age, whether we're looking at gender. There is a huge amount of bias in the recruitment process, and that's exactly what we're working to eliminate, or at least to improve on, right? So to find a new way and a new way of hiring, basically, a new way of sourcing and screening and assessing. And really, this is where the AI is able to be quite fair, surprisingly enough, more than the human, right? Than the human biases that exist.
So explain very simply how it works. You set up Searchy based in Dubai about a year ago. You've already raised several million dollars in venture capital funding. AI is part of the recruitment process. It's not a pure AI tool. Mm. In very simple terms that my grandmother could understand, how does the AI filter candidates?
All right, so imagine I gave everybody out there a recruitment assistant called Sarah or Ahmed and say, here you go. This is the person that will be calling all your candidates. They'll be interviewing all your candidates. And once they've done that, and they'll match them on your company culture and values. Once they've done that, they'll present to you five people and you can review their interviews and psychometric assessments. And you can do this in a day, 48 hours or a week, depending on the role. Imagine that is what we're doing, but with an avatar, right? So it's an avatar that is actually asking customized questions. And I think the simple fact is that
when so the AI is interviewing them. It's not just scanning a CV.
No, it's interactive. Not, yeah, so it's not scanning the CV. It's not looking for keywords, things like that. It's actually actively interviewing them, looking at microfacial analysis, the tone, their body language. And as human beings, if someone was to sit in front of me right now and I'm interviewing them, I'm already judging them from the minute they walk into the door. How do they sit? How engaged are they? Are they passionate about what they're saying? How is their tone? Does it match the words? This is exactly what the avatar is doing. We're looking at over 361,000 factors during a 20-minute interview, and not matching on what we believe. We're matching on what the employer has defined to us is their company culture.
Sahika Bennett is the CEO of Searchy, artificial intelligence-powered recruitment firm here in Dubai, talking about the issue of blind CVs here in Dubai. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Good evening. You're listening to The Business Breakfast Nightcap. I'm Brandy Scott.
Sir Tim Clark has been speaking at an aviation event. He's making headlines around the world for a number of things, and depending on what you care about, depends on which headline you've probably picked up. You've been listening a little bit to what he has to say, haven't you, Rich?
Well, here's the thing. He was speaking at something called AVSEC, which is the Aviation Security Summit, which happens in Dubai regularly. And so his main speech yesterday, and we can hear from that now, was about, as you would imagine, aviation security, a very, very important topic. The headlines about things like premium economy and Emirates results, they came from his interviews on the sidelines afterwards with reporters. And we'll get to those in a second. But first of all, let's hear from Sir Tim in his own words. This is his speech talking about cybersecurity. He talked about a range of issues. I've picked out just two. And the first one is the kind of new kid on the block when it comes to aviation security. When we think of it passing through metal detectors. But he says, actually, the kind of new generations of threats is cyber.
There's been a multitude of high-profile hacks which have compromised the personal information of millions of people around the world. In our industry, we saw hackers hit British Airways in 2018, affecting roughly 380,000 bookings made on its website and app. They hit Cathay Pacific's passenger data, impacting over 9 million customers, and this is the largest known aviation data breach to date. Hackers that got into the Marriott Starwood Hotel's reservation database stole personal information of an estimated 500 million guests. And just last week, subsidiaries of the low-cost airline Lion Air in Southeast Asia confirmed a massive data breach potentially impacting millions of their customers.
So that's the cyber threat, the new and emerging cyber threat. He says it's real, it's happening, and it's getting worse, and we have to combat it. But it's not just about robots and computers. He said, actually, a lot of the interesting work is being done around humans. Of course, it is people who fly on aeroplanes, and this is what he had to say.
Behavioural analysis, behavioural interviewing, and non-racial profiling, where we see exciting applications of neuroscience, psychology and behavioural studies.
That's the AVSEC bit of yesterday, the Aviation Security Summit in Dubai. I'm not going to lie, though, the interesting stuff happened afterwards on the sidelines.
Yeah, two big things that we're interested in here in the Business Breakfast. Number one was a hint of what we might get in Emirates' half-year results. Now, they're coming out next Monday. That's when they are due, although, of course, Emirates is not a listed company. So Tim did say that he expects it to have been better than the corresponding half-year period last year, so the first 6 months of 2018, despite the fact that they had a shut runway at Dubai International for 7 weeks, which we know a lot was done at DXB to minimise the interruption on airlines such as Emirates with that. But even so, a shut runway is a shut runway. The other thing that he said that has caught people's attention is the fact that Emirates is going to be delaying the launch of its premium economy class. Now, this is something that was announced a couple of years ago. Emirates started thinking about it around 2016. It won't be launching as expected in mid-2020, so the middle of next year, because it was looked at being done on the 777X wide bodies. They're expected to be delayed, so it looks like it will be coming at the end of next year, 6 months roughly later, on A380 double-deckers instead.
This disappoints me because I'm looking forward to premium economy because I think it's something that probably I want, but Emirates does need. If you look at the premium route that Emirates is flying at the moment, its obvious competitor to London is British Airways. They have four classes. Emirates just has three. Same with Etihad. I do think it's an omission.
I was having a look last night when I looked at these comments for some research about how popular premium economy actually is. Most of the research that I found was a little bit dated, a year to a year and a half old. But what it did suggest was that companies were looking at putting executives increasingly in premium economy rather than business class. So a saving for the company, but still not an uncomfortable flight for short to medium haul for the executives.
Mount, you're a regular customer of premium economy.
It would be my cabin of choice, to be honest with you. Slightly more expensive, but for a gentleman of ample proportions, you kind of need a little bit of substance, really. A slightly wider seat, a bit more legroom, and a bit more recline in your seat. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of premium economy. And when I search for flights, that would be the first one I go for. That's my default class.
You have to do the sums, though, because I've flown on Emirates, on airlines, sorry, actually not Emirates, with premium economy before. And I've actually done the geek thing that I never ever do of going onto the website. You know how there are websites that will tell you the pitch of a seat, it will tell you the girth of a seat. Do you know what I mean? It will compare models. Quite frankly, I don't do it. I generally think, you know, who has time? But I did have a look once fairly recently flying AN Other Airline to see whether there was any point in paying for premium economy, because there was quite a big price difference between either paying premium economy or just going for the extra legroom bulkhead seat. And actually, the extra legroom bulkhead seat was the far, far better deal in terms of getting yourself a lot more space and a better seat.
I guess there's only one or two of those seats, and if you're unlucky to get it straight away, you know, then
nine across an aisle, and depending on the size of the plane that you're going, there can be 20 odd of them.
The seat is the same size, of course. It's just an economy seat, isn't it? For me, it's an all-round package.
Yeah, you get more legroom, you don't get extra width.
In fact, you could argue you get less width, because those seats are often the one that have the, you can't lift the armrest, they have the fixed arms on them. So in fact, if you are rotund of bottom, you don't get the extra wiggle room, as it were. Literally the wiggle room, as it were.
Expansionary by nature.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow morning, 6 a.m. Have a great night.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.